the Sagebrush Variety Show!
Welcome to the Sagebrush Variety Show, sagebrushvariety.org, political commentary and satire. Today we bring you a special edition with a behind-the-scenes discussion on corporate crime with the writer, Kevin Bayhouse, and the actors. This was a serial drama we just completed. The story takes place in Idaho after peak oil has taken its hold on the American way of life and is set about 40 years into the future. Don't miss the premiere next week of Ukiah Digby for Coroner, our next serial radio play, as well as our usual programming. I'm Gwen Sankirico. Enjoy the show.
I see my role. I usually play a southern, I usually put a hickish accent into my characters because I figure, you know, they're from Boise and maybe they're the ones that survive. So I like to put that little touch. Not everybody does, but that's sort of my take on it. I haven't been many characters. I've been two. I think I was one guy playing in a poker game, and then I'm Lenny.
All right, well, I'm April Hoy, and I play Pat. Well, I've mostly played pretty minor characters, but I've done at least one of the main characters for me in this, with a southern accent, because the idea was that they were from a rural area, but she's really good on, you know, the technical stuff. She takes care of a lot of the logistics and a lot of the technical issues behind what's going on the Aggie Town. It's a fairly minor character who takes care of the technical stuff that needs to be done. But yeah, that's mainly what they do.
So what roles have you played on Corporate Prime?
Well, I played the armorer, mm-hmm. the Australian armorer from Corpy Town. I was the guy that handed out the weapons. I'm the one that runs the weapon shack at Corpy Town. And I also played Ken Dorn, the doctor from the Bahamas, who are now settled in this new Boise community. And I, like Stephen King, I play these minor characters of the creations that I've written. And so I'm comparing myself to Stephen King or anything. It's just
That's good.
Synonymous with that.
Tell us about your experience as the writer.
The writer. Well, I can tell you one thing. If you're going to write anything along with the demands and requirements, assumption something as large as this serial drama, you want to write it all out way ahead of time before you even record the first scene. And that's how I will do it again if I ever do it.
Learning
again.
The hard way.
Yes, yes. You don't try to write anything like this just a week ahead of time. I think while this is turning out well, I think, you know, you can actually get a better content if you get way ahead and out in front of it. Then you can kind of massage and improve it with more time to consult with people who can, you know, who's editing it. So yeah, that's my best suggestion to anybody else who wants to write, done ahead of time.
And how do you feel about the morons who edit it?
They're not morons.
How do you feel about the editors?
The editors are fine. They have writing experience, literal, you know. Sometimes I joke with myself that thanks for leaving a couple of punctuation marks in there. but I can somewhat recognize some of those.
That's what all writers
say. Yeah. But anyway, no, it's been good. I mean, sure, you might cut something that I kind of really wish I kept. But, you know, I'll just say, well, you know, if I would have written it out way ahead of time, I might have been able to had more time to change something to keep that thing I wanted to. But we've got a time, you know, I'm not going to get in the way of the wheels of progress. So we're going to get with the program here because I want to get with the program and stay on the clock. So I only got myself to blame for not writing it, you know, far enough ahead of time.
What about those sexual innuendos you keep on putting?
That's something that is in the minds of your minds that are not in mine.
Either that or the editors put it in.
That's what Disney said.
That's true. I think it's something the editors drop in there just to see who will recognize them for the jocularity content that we all enjoy.
That's Dan, there's even more of it today.
It's not yes. an innuendo. It's just sex talk.
It's just mad sex talk.
Oh, so who's your favorite character in the play?
My favorite character? Oh, there's so many. That's kind of tough. I think it comes down to the two principal characters. It's going to be Monica and David. It's going to be you're the ones that a lot of the content seems to focus on, and a lot of expression comes from, because that's where the philosophy debate happens, and that's kind of a big part of why I wrote this, is because the driver for writing this is to talk about the peak oil situation that I think is coming, and then I'm suggesting what potentially the outcome is going to be, and the discussions and the debates, or the information that's discussed and coming from Monica and David is the vehicle that gets that out there in front of everybody, and that's kind of the purpose of everything. So, like, for that reason, right there, that's why they'd be my favorite characters.
What's your role?
I'm Robert McMinn. I help edit the scripts, and I played Seely, who's a, paramilitary or quasi-military flunky of the corporate town boss, whose name is Bearclaw. And I think I have some other minor roles, and I'm team leader, who is this nerdy military guy who really gets into using the radio.
Can you do your team leader impression for us?
Nomad, do you read me, Nomad? Well, it sounds even better with the crackly stuff.
What's your favorite character in the whole thing?
Well, I don't know. That's a tough question. I really like the Pat character, but I kind of wrote that one, so maybe that's not fair. I think I totally invented Pat. And Pat,
well,
in my mind, yeah, well, people's performances make a big difference. And so in the beginning, Pat was kind of a minor character, but I like the way April played it. And I think that, that's sort of part of what kept it going. And Pat is sort of, and we used the name Pat because we didn't know whether a man or a woman would play that part of this person who would show up and do certain things. And so April started doing it. And I'd kind of written in this flirtatious thing that would work, whether it was a male or a female. It was somebody who was a playwright and who was sort of flirtatious. And I really like the Pat because the idea is that she's sort of, she's not particularly effeminate or masculine. She's kind of somewhere in the, she's sort of sexually dimorphous, but also very sexually forward. And people respond to her. And so it's that kind of character who you meet who, might even be bisexual, but who's like a little bit aggressive and flirty and kind of always changing roles and changing power relationships and sexual relationships with people. We'll have to bring Pat back into a subsequent script sometime because I really like that dynamic she creates whenever she's in a scene.
So at this point, we're not done writing the... with the writing or the production or the writing of the script. So who do you think David ends up with? Pat or Monica?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe Lenny.
Right. What do you think?
Oh, right.
Who's David going to end up with in this story?
Well, I kind of hope that he goes back to corporate town and converts Bearclaw. They have a happy love affair.
Harkening back to the first
as the writer,
segment.
I'm surprised that there is an assumption that he ends up with anybody.
Ooh.
But so I guess I have my writing directions.
Yeah.
He has to end up with somebody.
No, not necessarily.
Actually, I was thinking that he might end up with no one too.
That's kind of what I was thinking. Well, what do you think?
I think it could be anyone, possibly everyone, because everyone's just sort of
I think the real question, Gwen, is not who David's going to end up with, but who's going to end up with David. Because David, I'm not sure he has much game, but I can see a lot of people very attracted to him already. So it's who's going to seduce him. That's the real question.
Yeah.
So he's just waiting for someone else to make the move.
He is the unwitting character in our play. What?
Yeah, it's like everything's happening to him.
Yeah, he doesn't really know. He's just like
he's going almost along not with even it. Involved. He's
is just... he unwitting, or is that the Zen of his character? You know, or
it might be
maybe not even Zen, but it's either Zen or manipulative. I mean, that you know, it's a good way to get people Zen. To help Definitely you is by just sort of being there, being a strong presence, but sort of
it could be.
You know, it's through subtle manipulation, making them want to tell you what to do.
You know,
and then they think that they're telling you know that they have a hold on you, and really you're a free agent.
David is that alpha male, yes, David is that alpha male. And before Corpytown, he was probably involved in lots of sports. He was probably the head jock, and people are attracted to that sort of masculinity, that sort of that alphaness that he brings to the table. That even if he's not very smart, he holds a presence. That people respond to, and they like his just being relaxed all the time and just like going with whatever happens and very flowy.
I disagree. I think they're attracted to him partly because, you know, he's this kind of wounded character. He's escaped from this sort of terrible life in Corpytown, and that they realize he's sort of recovering from that. And I think that's part of why people are attracted to him, and partly because they respect him for being a survivor, so for having gone through all of that. And, for, you know, beginning to forge a new life for himself.
And there's also a lot of mystery behind David, because he doesn't really talk a lot.
We don't really know where he came from.
And I think that's
And that's secret. Part of the attraction, too.
I think everybody, and you know, I think this happens a lot in life, where people who don't talk too much and just say enough, and especially if they're good-looking, but not terribly handsome, and that's how I see David Ortega, as like, a pleasant-looking guy, average build, average age. He's just kind of average, but nice, you know? And he doesn't say much, so people make this assumption, hey, he's like us. Barraclough's like, he understands the corporate way. His poker buddies are like, he likes to kick back and have a couple beers. And all the Aggies are like, he's a radical dude, man. He's just waiting for someone to come along and lead him to the revolution. And everybody kind of assumes that he's what they want him to be because he's just such a nice blank slate. He's not too much of anything, so they just want to say and want to recruit him.
Post-apocalyptic peak oil Chauncey Gardner.
Yeah!
Well, I think I can shed some light on the character. Okay. What I had in mind when I wrote David Ortega's character is that in my mind, a lot of his alpha qualities existed previous to this mission he's been sent on. So, yeah, there was a mention early in the show where he was involved in a skirmish somewhere in, like, Wyoming or Utah, I forget which.
Wyoming.
Right. And he led, you know, he led an operation there to take care of some sort of trouble, blah, blah, blah. But we don't know, we didn't get to witness any of those qualities. And then at the, his position at the Corpytown where he ran a security section, we only get to see some of those, you know, him actually taking initiative there. So we don't really see his alpha qualities bearing out. This is the first mission, the mission that Barraclough sends him on. This is the first mission that he's ever, you know, in a covert type mission he's ever been sent on. He's a newbie. He's a very novice. His alpha qualities are not present, apparent. He's learning on the job. So we're not witnessing anything there that, like, of James Bond type of a character.
Were you thinking of Bond a little bit? Because sometimes I feel like, in your dialogue, some of the characters talk to him like a Bond. It's like, so, Mr. Ortega, I trust you enjoyed your voyage over here. We have been watching you.
This is dialogue that never made it to the final production.
Well, so we left some of it in, but like if it was too Bondy, I'd take it out. But I felt like there were hints of Bondiness to the way other people talk to him.
You make a great point, Kevin, when you say that maybe he hasn't gotten to demonstrate his alpha qualities. But I think the truth is he's alpha by his body language.
Sinking sin, man.
You can quote me on that one.
I love it. I love it. All right.
I find it interesting how, like, the primary author of this piece has such a relatively small piece of ownership of the characters from this discussion around the table.
That's true.
And it's not just because, I mean, it's not just because of the editing, though. It's because of, like, you know, the way, like, the actors and other people's perception and, like, taken in this whole other direction, you know?
Right. I know I have given a lot of latitude. I have not done too much directing to try to keep everybody in a tight cord or anything that, you know, in a frame of what I kind of expected the characters to unfold when I was writing it. And that's okay. It's an experiment and it's been fun. And, you know, I'm not like a rigid ogre to, you know, as far as, you know, trying to, you know, make
you're
sure
not
something.
An ogre.
Yeah. I guess, yeah. Yeah. What is there such thing as you're saying? Right? You know, maybe next time. And I'll
maybe next time. Why?
Maybe next time I'll keep everybody more.
He'll be more ogrely.
But it doesn't necessarily work. I mean, look what happened with, like, Ukiah Digby.
With the character who played Lyndon, totally changed the way I looked at that. And, like, everybody really changed, yeah. You know. And then my character was a little like the Ortega character in the beginning, where he really wasn't very interesting. And Gwen really kind of pushed me to make him heroic in some way.
I'm Khalil Inane, and I play David Ortega in Corporate Prime. I try to think of Bruce Campbell's character in Evil Dead or Army of Darkness, or any movies ever played ever, that character. Try to think about him when I'm doing the voice for David Ortega.
And who's your favorite character in the play?
I'm my favorite character in the play.
I like all.
April, who's your favorite character in Corporate Prime?
Hard to say. I guess my favorite character would probably be Team Leader. I just like the voice.
It's all about the voice in radio.
My favorite character, it's a tie between Monica and Seeley.
That's interesting.
That's
cool. Why is that?
Because Monica is ultra feminine and Seeley is ultra masculine. And I think those two characters are very, very, very opposing forces. And it's kind of. it's interesting how Monica.
It's interesting how you see it that
both
way.
Masculine,
how Monica's like.
And the other one's. No, one's feminine and the other's masculine.
Monica's like the VP in Aggie Town, and Seeley's the VP in Corpy Town. And I think that there you can draw a very distinct parallel.
Oh, you mean Barraclough, not Seeley.
No, I mean Seeley.
Seeley's the, like, okay, boss.
Barraclough's the president, right?
Yeah.
CEO.
Seeley's the VP.
VP.
And then Lenny, I thought, was the president of Aggie Town.
I don't think
interesting, okay, interpretation. We'll let's consult the writer for clarification on that.
Well,
and of course, keeping in mind that things change as we record.
Seeley's one of the higher up, more executive section chiefs for the security establishment in Corpy Town. I don't know if he's. There's unseen executives, characters that we don't meet or won't meet
on both
there.
Sides.
Yeah, on both sides. But for all practical purposes, you're correct that what we're listening to, Seeley would be the probably the second in command of who we hear.
And then Monica and Aggietown.
In Aggietown, yeah, we really haven't met any of the administrators.
Well, that's because originally Monica was written as like the leader of the Treasure Valley,
right.
And the editors
that.
Totally deconstructed.
And that was
that
a good idea
because we wanted a decentralized government.
Yeah.
We didn't want this.
Right.
Corporate,
I'm glad we rewrote it.
Authoritarian structure.
Right.
The eventual lead up to David becoming so-called king of Aggietown. with you know, him and Lenny duking it out for power. I can totally see this happening in Aggietown. And I mean,
right.
God forbid Corpy Town come in
and
under
whoever,
the circumstances.
Whoever nails Monica gets to be president.
She's downright the queen already.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
It's got all my internal struggles. It's like an Anne Mann novel, really. It's a struggle for the mightiest individual who will rule Aggietown. It's actually quite thrilling.
It's a very dynamic play, and I'm very proud to be a part of it.
You're listening to the Sagebrush Variety Show on Radio Boise, a service of Boise Community Radio.
We're discussing Corporate Prime, the serial drama we just completed last week. We'll be back to our regular format next week. Let's talk about Pat.
Everybody loves Pat. Or anyway, Pat loves everyone.
That's what I say.
She's kind of fun. She's kind of like this cross between militant bisexual and dirty old man.
Well, I guess the question is, like, in a place that wasn't the Boise we imagined, would that person not fit in so well? Or what would happen? Would they be totally different? Would they suppress themselves? Or would they not be such a loved and active member of the community? Or what would happen? You know, and that was one of the things I wanted to explore. I mean, I've actually met people like that. But, you know, they travel in certain circles. They're not going to go into the local hardware store and just flirt with the
salespeople.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I could imagine that sort of person being in Boise, but probably not as politically involved. Definitely not as sort of productive in the community, just kind of, you know, party, good time. You'd invite them to a party and you'd have a good time.
Right.
But you wouldn't really do activism or community service type stuff with
them. I mean, obviously, the community's more accepting of sexual diversity.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Right? Is that necessarily a part of having that kind of agricultural world where people are really sharing resources and have to work together? You know, some people think that after peak oil happens, you're actually going to get an even stronger push for so-called traditional values.
I could see that happening because it'd be a nation of small towns.
Strict gender roles.
Yeah, but we're showing the alternative to that.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
In that Treasure Valley community.
Yeah, there's a conscious effort, I think, to try to promote diversity.
There are different paths things can take in post-peak oil world. On the one hand, when resources are scarce, food is scarce, energy is scarce, there, you know, you could easily imagine a tendency towards hoarding and not sharing and fighting or killing over these things. And extreme problems with equal distribution. Or you could see it as a situation where people realize that if they don't work together, they're going to die.
Right.
So those are the choices. And depending on the makeup of the community, it'll go one towards one of those scenarios or the other.
There's the all for themselves crowd. Then there's going to be people that recognize right away that that's not going to get you anywhere. So they're going to be searching out like-minded allies. So you could have different groups of people, and it'll be like, you know, your progressive group, and then you'll be your kind of your religious community group that already have a kind of a social structure, and even a kind of a social welfare structure within them, and they already are, you know, that's the first step. And then if they recognize that a crisis like that comes, then they band together, and then they will already be sharing.
I could easily imagine, though, there still being a lot of people sort of left over, it's especially in Idaho, sort of going it on their own, and whatever's left of the national forests at this point, and sort of a solitary survivalist kind
of. Yeah, and I recognize
that. A lot of people set up for that.
Well, for various reasons, we chose to focus on the story of the corporate town and the agricultural village that was the Treasure Valley. You know, what it had become. But we talked a lot about what else would be out there. We never really had a chance to explore that because it would have brought so much more in there. It would have been a longer series, a lot more work to compose. But that was one of the questions. You know, are there people out there just scavenging randomly? Are there different kind of fights still going on? I mean, one of the reasons why someone might go to a place like Corporate Prime is because it does have a certain degree of safety. And if you're not in Corporate Prime, you know, we were sort of saying, well, there's Corpy towns and Aggie towns. Are there crappy towns? Corpy towns and crappy towns, where it's sort of like the Wild West.
And we didn't discuss, we didn't get into the crappy towns.
Right.
We kind of very remotely hinted at it in some of David's dialogue where he says where he was from.
Right.
We didn't have a chance to explore that. Okay. And what goes on in a crappy town, we figure it is
people shoot you for a pair of sneakers.
Yeah, they haven't gotten it together.
Or a tin of tuna. You know, nobody's doing any kind of agriculture to speak of. If they are, someone else is just going to come and steal it from them. You know, you have to guard it with your life. You know, they're probably eating wild animals if they can get their hands on them. Just whatever. And then lots of scavenging and very little honest work.
hierarchy of fear, the fastest gun gets the most of what there is. And everybody respects that person, whoever it is. And then sort of like a little pyramid builds around that person, but they're living in fear. And then when somebody tries to challenge them, you know, it's like they either succeed and knock them off, and they become the new fear monger or deliberator of...
I could see that of existing sort of in the earlier days after peak oil. Maybe that sort of being a preliminary stage where it sort of mm-hmm. evolved into communities like the Aggie towns where people just sort of got together and started cooperating, or situations where someone was able to hoard enough and, you know, reach a point of, you know, sufficient inequality and distribution of resources that they could take control and become a CEO of Corpy Town.
Why is it that the David Ortega character, who obviously, you know, it's clear, he's made it clear that he's done some things he's not proud of, right, just for his own survival. And he gets sent on this mission, and it changes his heart. And it seems that he's just really completely absorbed very quickly the values of the community. Where the Monica character is basically the person who recruited David. I mean, she was supposed to be spying on him, but she recruited him and showed him how great the life was. And she seems to recognize that, and yet she has trouble giving herself up to that. Why do you think that is?
No, I think she has some guilt about having participated in this Corpy Town sort of culture, and she's still trying to adjust to a new way of living, but I don't know, she still has this baggage from the Corpy Town. And
so maybe she's actually trapped by her own morality, where like Ortega's like, yeah, well, I did that, I did what I had to do, and then he just moves on. It's more of a...
Yeah, that could be.
Well, you played Monica, Gwen. So part of how it evolves is from how the writers hear you play it, and then the next week we go back and write more. I mean, what did you think was going on with Monica?
I think it was more of a device or technique to highlight David's transformation to totally accepting life in the Treasure Valley and looking forward to it. So he had totally changed. Whereas Monica, who had already been there for a while and we thought was already integrated into the community and totally into it, turns out she still has issues. And I think those issues stem from, you know, having spent part of her life in a Corpy town. And I think that served to illustrate that there's damage to living a life like that, where your freedom is limited and your brain isn't very stimulated.
What did you originally think, Kevin, when you originally got the ball rolling on the Monica character? Did you know where you thought it was going to go, or what kind of person did you originally think you were going to have?
Well, the character started out to be an administrator, and then that seemed unsuitable.
Why wasn't it suitable to just have an administrator?
Well, it seemed like unlikely that an administrator would take the recruitment role. Actually, it was a confrontation more than anything. When I first wrote it, it was a direct confrontation. It wasn't even recruitment. It was like calling him out right there.
Uh-huh.
And we needed to change that so we could develop a more interesting, you know,
So we thought we were headed in a direction where it was this kind of bureaucratic life. It was this agricultural bureaucracy, you know, where people were nominally equal, but people were really obsessed with.
Yeah.
How you felt? Like, that's what I thought we were kind of worried about, was that we were making it seem like it wasn't really a fun life. The whole life was like, you must go here at this time. You know, the Central Committee says you must live in the East Sector.
Well, it was more like the administrator character turned out to be kind of like a bully character or we know best. Would not have been a sympathetic character. And they were kind of compassionless and bureaucratic, like you're saying. And that needed to change. So we needed to develop somebody who could, you know, somebody that more realistically that David would
be drawn to.
Yeah, be drawn to, be attracted to on you know, many levels. An emissary. We needed a really good emissary. And Monica turned out to be a good emissary character for the values of the community.
Except she turned out to be a psycho.
You think so? You think she was?
Well,
she's damaged. But that was a cool thing that I thought we kind of, by the end, we showed that it's still not that simple. Yeah. So I think that you had this idea where it was kind of a utopia, but you wanted to show how much we had lost and how life is hard and how there's a struggle to make your food and to produce things and tools when you don't have this seemingly limitless energy source.
Right.
So, I mean, I think you originally wanted to have some kind of cautionary tale in there for people today saying, oh, you know, life might be hard in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the struggle was, we also kind of wanted to show, we wanted to sort of guide our audience to what they might want to start working on right now.
Right.
To a better way of life.
Right.
Whether or not they believe in peak oil. But especially if and when we run out of oil in our lifetimes and we're panicking on how to restructure the world, how are we going to do it, you know?
Right.
And then people are going to say, remember that Corporate Prime play and the Aggie Town of Treasure Valley?
Right.
Let's create that kind of play.
Oh,
but I mean, the struggle was still to make it realistic so that people weren't always, it wasn't all, you know, oh, what a lovely utopia we have and there's never any problems and no, you know, consequences to any mistakes.
Yeah, like Boise Valley Smurfs. I really like the ending, the way we had sort of this, still this conflict within the community about, you know, what is an acceptable level of violence, which I thought was actually kind of refreshing in these, the age of the war on terror, when we just sort of, it's really common to tune into the news and just hear, you know, death tolls, and they just sort of, you don't really feel anything to them. It's, mm-hmm. you know, like, oh, well, that's the cost of war. I think it's really interesting that we've gone back to a system where each death, you know, has to be sort of considered, you know, on a moral basis. Society has to consider, you know, was it really worth killing that person for what we achieved? And, you know, is there some other way we could have done it?
Is it possible that we could have made a stronger statement by having them refuse to kill anybody?
I'm not sure. I think that might have been oversimplifying because they've got this, you know, sort of malevolent kind of force out that's trying to destroy them. And I think going for anything as simple as pacifism, no questions asked, would have been too simple. It's a really messy world, and I think we need sort of the complications of conflict.
Right.
Kevin, you were kind of the primary author, but in a lot of ways it kind of spun away from all of us, but especially you.
Yeah.
At the very end, do you feel like we, like in the end, we accurately represented that debate? About
well,
how much violence is enough violence, and what's preemption,
I could
what's
have
prevention.
Easily, I know, I could have easily, I think I accidentally wrote something that turned out to draw the debate out, because all my alternatives were, I could have written it to where it was a quite simple ending without any real moral conflict. I could have had our groups, the Razor groups, surround these guys and just wait them out and say, there, see, that was easy. They wait them out, they give up, and it's all over with. And you don't run into the conflict, the moral conflict about, well, when do you have to use violence? You know. So while I think I probably went, in retrospect, I went a little overboard in having the sniper just take out the first guy.
Well, you were very protective of the community you created.
Well, that and the fact that, yeah, I was, and I looked at, I think that you have the right to defend yourself and the things you that really were worth something. You know, that came down to a real serious choice, and my mentor even has expressed that so about, you know, someday you may have to question what you think about using violence. And, you know, and everybody knows my mentor is Noam Chomsky. He's talked about, about the use of violence before. And this is like a super pacifist person. But you really have to justify it. And so I created a situation where we're going to have to justify it, you know. But it was good that that there was consequences about the shooting. And so Lenny, you know, really ripped him a good new one and during the party. And then the council also had serious questions for the perpetrators of that act. So yeah, killing is too easy. It comes too easily. I mean, you read it in the New York paper every day over in Iraq and stuff like that. And these questions aren't being answered. It's all just, oh, pragmatism dictates that we've got to do this. Of course, we have to look at it under a different set of circumstances involved, too. The whole thing driving our violence overseas has nothing about defense. This was a pure defensive, you know, a straight-out defense act, whereas everything else that we're seeing and witnessing in the world, hardly any real self-defense act, I think, is taking place that we ever get to read about or hear about.
What I really liked with the ending, with the debate, I liked the way the main characters basically lost the debate. That it wasn't just sort of clean cut, you know, these are the protagonists, so they must be right. That there was sort of a legitimate debate about it.
I'm glad I liked that, too.
Yeah.
Because I have a certain amount of ambivalence towards that. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm a member of the Green Party, and one of the values, key values, is nonviolence, And within the Green Party, people argue about it, what that means and how far it goes. But, you know, we're not, there are Quakers in the organization, but it's not like a, you know, not everybody follows that strict. You can't fight no matter what.
There's a huge spectrum within that nonviolence category from like total absolute pacifism, non-resistance to, well, violence is okay, but only self-defense.
One of the debates we had as like a writing team was, you know, you wanted to draw some parallels to international relations and the way that violence, the military violence, is used to protect the United States hegemony. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's like good stuff to talk about, but I was always thinking about keeping it local. So, you know, being a community radio show and right now just being syndicated in Idaho. So I was sort of more trying to imagine what's our culture and how would our culture translate, you know, into this imaginary post-peak oil future. And I mean, it's the same issues, you know, I mean, we play that out on the world stage, but it's like if we were stuck with each other and those are the only people we have to fight or other residents of the United States, what are we going to choose to do? You know, what paths will we take given the kinds of people who already exist here? One of the themes of the serial drama Corporate Prime is energy. It's a post-peak oil fiction, and we have some leftover nuclear power plants apparently in the play, and then we talk about some other ways that people might use energy. We could have talked about that more, but there's always a question of what makes good drama. Kind of like before, you talked about the waiting game, you know, how part of the reason I think we didn't have your defense team wait out the assault team was because it wouldn't have made good radio. It would have been like, well,
that's right,
they're going to run out of food sooner or later.
That's right.
One place.
Yep.
We needed action, you know, because right. Sitting and waiting them out is
but
no
we
action.
Did talk about, we did find a chance to talk about energy in the play.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I kind of feel like we could have talked about it more, but some, certain episodes we really went into it.
You're listening to the Sagebrush Variety Show, political commentary and satire with an irreverent twist.
We're discussing Corporate Prime, the serial drama we just completed last week. We'll be back to our regular format next week.
What were some of the more interesting debates about when we were envisioning how we were going to talk about people's energy use?
Well, David was assigned to make a map of all the energy centers in the Treasure Valley, and his communications via radio with the assault team revealed a lot about that, because he discovered that I was mostly decentralized.
Right.
And there's a hydro plant,
mm-hmm.
Lucky Peak Dam, still right. Standing 40 years from now.
Yeah, it's amazingly. Yeah, they must have done a good job.
So there's a good amount of energy from there. And considering there's only 50,000 people in the valley, as there's that is kind of like a big chunk. And then everything, a solar tree is mentioned, and it's discussed in a little more detail on our blog at sagebrushvariety.blogspot.com. It's just an idea that I came up with and kind of developed with someone else. Didn't go anywhere, but maybe somebody will do something with it someday. You know, your average deciduous tree contains about a square acre of surface area in its leaves. Mm-hmm. But as you must certainly realize, it doesn't take up a whole acre.
Right.
So it's a very efficient use of space. And with when you want to collect solar energy, it's really good to maximize and have creative ways to come up with surface area for the photovoltaic cells. So that's a design that we thought we might throw in there. Although, you know, the actual manufacturing and...
Right.
Would it take a lot of energy to build a solar tree?
Of those things might, I don't know. I mean, if you have spare parts, you could probably, you know, throw stuff together.
Or it could have been, in the writer's mind, it might have been something that got produced before peak oil at the very end of peak oil. You know, a lot of stuff will be produced. Stuff's being produced now. Prototypes, things like that, if you get a hold of. Why not?
It might have been thrown together afterwards from salvaging old solar panels and other materials.
But our main point was, but the main theme we always had was that there's not a lot of energy to go around. So people were always talking about only doing this or that for emergencies. And a lot of things were like hand generated. And if you wanted to send a radio message, you had to get on the bike for a while.
Right. And you can generate enough.
I want to know why gyms aren't generating electricity. I mean, there's all this.
They should.
There's all this, you know, mechanical work.
I've heard
gone
it.
Gone to waste.
I know. I've heard it more than once.
And instead of creating energy, it's sucking up energy.
Right.
That is so.
I know. I've heard it more than once suggested that they should hook them up to be. They should all be.
And then instead of paying, go into the gym. Maybe you could even go and make a few cents. Like, not a lot of money, you know, but like maybe if you could just get like a buck, you know, for going to the gym for a couple hours. Like, I'd like that.
Get a rebate. No, they
could. Right. Well, you didn't pay to go to the gym and then you get a buck back. You go for. It's free to go to the gym. You go to one of the local municipal gyms, and they give you a dollar, you know, or something.
What other gadgets did we mention in the series? There were those rail bikes.
Oh yeah,
which are in existence.
That they are. Yeah, that basically it's a you know, normal bicycle rides on one side of one rail, and then it's got a like a spar or a truss that goes over to and one another wheel that runs to the other side on the other rail that basically holds you up, and so you just, you know, down the rail you go, and as long as there's nobody coming the other direction, coming fast behind you, you all sort of have to go the same direction. So I was trying to think about how we would do that. It's like,
well, there's usually two sets of rails.
On the existing rail that we have available to us for this story. It's one way, so you'd almost have to schedule an east-west transit. You know, it's like, okay, everything is going this way for this time, and then you turn around and you have to get off. You can pick the rail bike off.
Yeah, well, they're light. If you see somebody coming, you just kind of get off the rail.
Right. There are some switches. There's some other sightings here and there along here between here and Napa.
Weren't the pumped rail cars? You know, like you see them in
cartoons.
Movies.
Right.
Well, but also did people actually use those for transportation during the Depression?
Yes, they did. Mm-hmm. And they can go
where they get a hold of them.
Those seesaw handles.
Yeah. What was the deal? I mean, did they just like if they heard a train coming? But like if you're exerting yourself and they're probably pretty squeaky, you might not hear the train.
I think
maybe
it
would
stop,
see you and go whoa,
get off and pull it off the tracks. And when the train passes, put it back on the tracks.
Do you hear it coming though?
Oh,
well,
there was
obviously you do. Otherwise,
yeah, no, they can hear because they were steam locomotives, and they make a big racket, you know.
Especially if they honk at you,
yeah, and stuff. And then if they can hear the whistle in the background, then they know they're coming or something, or way off into the distance, and then they can feel it in
just
the rails.
Like the big black cloud.
Yeah, some people can feel the vibration in the rails, and then they know it's coming.
Yeah, you just pass out.
Is that like a genetic
deprivation from the coldest?
You're like born with that, the ability to feel the vibrations in the rails.
Yeah, you can actually feel when stuff's coming. I used to do it because I used to mess around the railroad tracks when I was a kid a little bit.
Is there any more about energy?
There were solar lamps, lighting streets, some streets.
Right, and those are in existence now too.
Yeah, and Idaho is a pretty good place for solar powered because we got so much sun.
Right.
And also for wind and geothermal. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Not just shallow, but deep geothermal as well.
Right. I think the geothermal option is not completely exploited properly here, because I keep hearing about this geothermal plant over in Napa right now at the old hospital that's sitting there doing nothing, and it's you can get it functional with not too much of an investment. So I think that if, you know, there and over here, I'll bet you there's more opportunity than
we led to believe. Did we talk about geothermal? And
I don't think we did.
We didn't.
That's too bad. We should have had someone go hot springing, too. Maybe that's where you could recruit somebody to the Aggie Ring.
We also had a dance scene where the music, you might have noticed, is not amplified. It's just fiddle. And, you know, for thousands of years, people had parties and danced to music that was produced on acoustically amplified instruments, you know, with big sound boxes or whatever stuff.
And they're loud.
And they are really loud.
They were trying to get away from the sound of bagpipes.
I still don't understand.
Saturday mornings when I ride to work, I hear them.
I mean, go see a band nowadays and they mic the drums. And, I mean, really, you don't need to mic the drums because you can hear them no matter where you are.
But. Yeah, so all you bands who mic the drums, you're wasting electricity.
Well, no, you do it so you get the levels more even and you have more control over the sound. Yeah, whatever. You're a musician, so you know, yeah, if you're a real musician, you should be able to control that on your own by your playing. So there.
And what about, like, hurdy-gurdy?
Oh, hurdy-gurdies are cool. I love hurdy-gurdies.
They're loud. It's a synthesizer that doesn't need electricity.
Well, it's called a medieval synthesizer. Yeah, because it plays a rhythm, because it's... Well, it's okay, first, a hurdy-gurdy is this kind of boxy thing with a... Kind of like a fretboard, but instead of frets, it's got keys. And it's got strings, and instead of bowing or plucking or strumming the strings, it's got this wheel that's rosined, and it's got a crank, and you turn the crank, and this wheel turns, and it makes all the strings vibrate. So you get these drone strings, and then the keys change the, you know, you play notes on the other strings. And then it's got notches cut into the wheel sometimes, the really cool ones, the Swedish ones, and that cranks out a rhythm. So it's got the rhythm, it's got the drone, which is just kind of a staple of medieval music, and then you have the melody.
Isn't there a show that's going to be in Radio Boise's next season schedule that's going to play hurdy-gurdy music?
Yeah. Cool. And some other stuff. It's called Snow and Thunder. It's a one-hour show.
So they can see that if they go to the Radio Boise schedule, radioboise.org.
Yeah.
And click on schedule.
Yeah. Cool. Find it there. And some other cool new shows.
So other speculative peak oil imagining, because we're kind of already coming in here. What would it mean for musicians to have a post-peak oil economy? What would it be like to be a musician?
It's going to be harder to be a musician because you have to be that much better. You know, if you sing, you got to have the lung power. You got to know how to project. You know, forget all that opera stuff, but there's like all these different ways of singing that makes your voice carry. And it's also a good thing because it allows for more diversity too.
Mm-hmm. What about the music industry though? So, but not everybody's going to be trying to be Kurt Cobain, right? Or Coldplay. I mean, right now, either you play your music for a couple of beers a week, you know, and this, we're talking hours and hours of rehearsal, plus the amount of time that you spend in the bar playing for people and then trucking all your equipment around and then always like dreaming you're going to get a record deal, right? So either you just do it purely out of the love of it and it's financially, it's a cruddy life, or you make tons and tons of money like Coldplay. I mean, I know that there's some people in the middle, right? But like it's kind of set towards the extremes. Do you think post-peak would that flatten out because there's not going to be a record industry?
Yeah, it's right. Not a business anymore. It's
so every town's going to have musicians and they're going to be treated pretty well.
Yeah, and then each town will probably develop its own special sound.
What I could picture,
just like in the old days.
What I could picture happening would be that, you know, there would be sort of local sounds and there would be a lot of local musicians and people who would play not as anything they devote a large amount of time to, but they could, you know, whip out a guitar at a party or something. But then there are probably also going to be, you know, kind of like minstrel groups that would make it more of a profession and might sort of travel between the different towns even, potentially.
Oh, I think it's going to be a good, great thing for the music.
Yeah, well, I think looking back in history would be a pretty good indicator of what things might be like. And that's what you had going on in pre-industrial times, before stuff was automated and mass-produced.
Right.
And, you know, musicians had a whole lot of respect back then, so peak oil might not be a bad thing for some people.
You know, recorded music has all kinds of nuances. You know, even recording this show is actually a lot more difficult than some people might realize. Like, a show like this, we're just talking, we're editing, it's still going to take a few hours. But, like, our actual shows, you know, I don't know, like, I don't want to make any... our listeners feel guilty or like they should be more grateful to us.
Or
but
appalled.
I mean, yeah, or appalled, but there's like hundreds of hours going to the show. I mean, the writing is some of that, you know, and the actual acting is some of it. But I mean, a lot of the production work is a lot of the production and editing is a significant amount of time.
Of it.
Yeah. And we're pretty amateur.
That was a book about automation called Player, and it was like the first book that talked about, like, you know, the Luddism, one of the first books that discussed Luddism.
Well, let's get one thing straight. We are not Luddites, but we do have to face the facts that we're not going to have as much stuff, like energy, as we do now.
Right. We're not.
You have to accommodate that. Otherwise, you're going to be really miserable.
Right. We're not Luddites, but how automation is being used unjustly in manufacturing and in factories and things, that's going to go away and the power's going to return to the shop floor.
Yeah, woo! All have jobs
sweet.
Again.
You know, and then
power to the people.
Right. And then they get to dictate the pace of manufacturing once again. That's coming back because energy, again, it's an energy thing.
Well, as long as we have food.
But the thing is, I think...
That's going to be the main thing.
that's another problem.
I think a lot of people have a little bit of Luddite in them. I mean, I don't know if I'm a strict Luddite, you know, but honestly, I'm a little bit of a Luddite, you know, some days. I like to get the Luddite on.
Right.
Well, I recognize that I'm not a Luddite, and I am a technophile. I love technology. Some technology I hate, like biotechnology, for example.
Right.
And fragrance technology I really hate, because it makes me miserable. Right. But... you know, there are different kinds of technology, and just because there's one way of making something or getting something done doesn't mean it's the only option.
Right.
And, you know, if you look at ancient civilizations like the Romans or the Chinese or the Egyptians or the Mayans, well, they had the means for a lot of physical comfort.
Right.
They had their own technology. It was different technology than what we use now. But... a lot of it is still more efficient than some of the technology we use today.
Right.
Like ways of, you know, cooling structures and stuff. I mean, we're recording this in Kevin's basement because it's cooler here than in the Radio Boise studio. And we have to run the AC to do that over there. And it's right. still not. And here there's nothing. It's
we're just underground. Yeah.
So that's a simple example.
Right.
You know, digging a hole is technology.
Right.
It is.
Right. Right.
And, you know, just because you prefer digging a hole than, you know, running some centralized, inefficient air cooling system.
Right.
You know, in downtown Boise, that does not make you a Luddite.
That's right.
Thank you very much. I just want to get that off my chest. Right.
That's good. That's right. very valuable.
Right. Well, I think that I...
Well, I'm not a Luddite either.
I don't think so.
We just like digging holes.
I love digging holes, and
different holes serve different purposes.
Since I was a small child, I've dug holes. Well,
I tried to. My parents never let me dig holes as a child. I wanted to create big holes and tunnels and things.
Well, let's acknowledge Luddism is a political term used by the ruling class to basically control workers.
To squelch your creative ideas.
Exactly. That's what it all ever was.
With regard to hole digging.
You're listening to the Sagebrush Variety Show, sagebrushvariety.org. Political commentary and satire with an irreverent twist from Boise, Idaho.
One of the things the Sagebrush Variety Show likes to talk about in all of our skits and dramas is food. Food politics, food art, food, food, food. So how does food come up in Corporate Prime?
Well, I like that scene. Some of David's co-workers are playing a poker game, and they say, hey, so-and-so is going to bring fresh pineapple. And they all get excited, and it turns out to be canned pineapple. But that's their idea of fresh pineapple, because like, pineapples don't grow in Idaho or anywhere near it, and because of the energy issues, you're not going to like ship pineapples to some working serfs in New Arco City.
So it was fresh at one point, like
before it went into a can, and
you're thinking post-peak, that's how people would think. They'd get excited about something like a canned food that they never see anymore, that's become sort of rare.
I'd say so.
It's like candy. Yeah, stuff made with ingredients you can't produce locally, because it's just too much energy to transport them. And, you know, all our food nowadays, I mean, what's the average meal travels 2,500 miles? Unless you really, really make a concerted effort to buy vegetables and things locally. And if you buy anything processed, then forget it. Certainly not local.
Is everything they eat in Corporate Prime processed? I don't know if that's clear.
No.
At one point, we refer to people not really understanding how to farm. But it seems like they'd have to farm some, glorify it. Like maybe...
Right. Yeah. And you know it's going to be monoculture. And it's going to be basically another, you know, continuation of the kind of the corporate way of farming type thing. Mm-hmm. And their version of efficiency versus the different model of in the Treasure Valley.
The way I saw it was that the contrast of the village that modeled itself on a corporation saw food as a necessity, something to get out of the way, get on the production line so that people could, as fuel, so that people could continue to make stuff, to make profit. And then occasionally someone might get excited about a bottle of scotch or something like that.
Right.
But in the Treasure Valley that we imagined, people celebrate food.
Right.
You wrote that in very early on, that everybody knows how to cook.
Right.
And that there's some people are better than others, but people are always comparing. Like, oh, they did this little trick with food, and
right.
there's a big diversity of crops and approaches. I wanted to give them the
time to do it. Thing is you, they have much more control over their time. It's not a corporate dictated work structure or business structure. It's not about business anymore. It's just about living.
So obviously the canned food is really, really old.
Right. If right? you find it, it is. Because I mean, who's going like to get bunker. It canned, you know?
I mean, if you think of all the food on the shelves in supermarkets or warehouses in tin cans or aluminum cans right. or whatever cans.
Right.
And with mass migrations and stuff that That's might occur from gone. Non-sustainable areas after you just peak oil.
Stumble on it.
Yeah. So there's going to be these caches of canned goodies.
Right.
By then.
Well, how many of the warehouses and supermarkets would have already been wiped out sort of in the early days of when people were, you know, warring with each other, sort of the right. the crappy town phase.
So that can of pineapple would be real rarity.
Yeah, especially if it's still good.
Yeah.
Even reference botulism.
Yeah. And the only canning that'd be going on is the kind you could still do if you still got those Kerr home canning yeah. jar, you know, glasses with the canner and everything. Like, people would be doing that.
I mean, a lot of, you know, our show is fairly militantly vegetarian. I don't think there are a lot of militant vegetarians in the world. And in my life, you just can't get along with other people if you're a militant vegetarian. So I think the idea of militant vegetarian is kind of a myth. To help people feel better about eating meat. But yet, on this show, this is our chance to kind of let our colors fly. And all the characters are vegetarian. All of our, like, most of our skits, like, mention vegetarianism or pure vegetarianism or veganism or something like that.
Right.
Bucky Bacaw eats eggs, but only from the backyard chickens that he spoils. And he doesn't eat chickens. So we talk about that in Corporate Prime, but only a little bit.
We got rid of cows. Alex or Leon in the card game right. talked about that cattle industry is gone.
Why would we do that?
Because I don't think it can survive without any kind of transportation fuels and all those kinds of inputs. Right. That's why
we're saying it won't take militant vegetarians to get rid of.
It's going to kill itself.
A cattle industry.
I like that we brought up that just how just stupidly unsustainable it is, because aside from the fact that you have all the transportation costs, there's the fact that it's just so grossly inefficient to produce a pound of meat as opposed to producing a pound of soybeans or a pound of potatoes or
16 pounds of grain.
So you think that's why the people of Treasure Valley imagined, is that why they're vegetarian? Because you mentioned, in fact, I think you even say vegan.
Yeah, I think I did.
Yeah,
you and did. Maybe that's yeah. really kind of like a little personally promotional, you know.
Well, if you don't have cows, you're not going to have dairy, so it's
right.
probably going to be vegan. And
goats, you know, chickens, when, I don't know.
When
what's
energy,
sustainable?
Water, and all these things are so limited, why are you going to feed your food to an animal
right.
so you can eat the animal when right. you could eat the food several times over yourself?
Right. Right, that's that formula
that's,
right there.
That's the concept. That's just the basic idea and the efficiency.
In your view, what's the main theme?
Face reality now and yeah. do something about it before it's course. Too late. Change course.
Yeah, make it. You make the transition into what is a desirable social structure of the Aggie Town or the Treasure Valley or whatever it's going to become. All the positives that are clearly there that you'd want, that are desirable in any event, make the transition into that as least painful as possible. You know, like, I won't call them luxuries.
I guess to me the main message was that we're really sort of coming up to a crossroads of which way we're going to turn in our society, that there is going to be life after oil, but what kind of life it's going to be could be much better, could be much worse. that the kind of world that we have after oil is going to be controlled a lot by how we decide to approach it. Are we going to go into peak oil kicking and screaming and trying desperately to hold on to what we have, or are we just going to face facts and try to, you know, forge a new world with what we have?
To me, I was thinking more about the human race has faced extinction several times, and we always find some way out of it, and then we create new problems. The opportunity that we have every time there's this big sea change is to create a different kind of community where there can be all different kinds of people, and people can be complicated and have problems, but where you have a community that brings out the best in everyone. And so that was my choice to end it that way. Even though it was corny, it's so hard to end a thing and not make it corny. And to me, we'll either go extinct or we won't, or we'll manage to kick and scream through some other phase of human development. And who knows how we'll figure out a way for a maximum amount of our species to survive. But beyond extinction, it's a question of how you can do it with quality so that you can have a joyful life.
That wraps up our special presentation of Corporate Prime Behind the Scenes with Kevin Bayhouse, April Hoy, Jeremy Sinkinson, Khalil Linane, Robert McMinn, and Gwen Sankirico. The Sagebrush Variety Show is funded in part by a grant from the Green Institute with support from Boise Community Radio. For more information on the show, visit our website at sagebrushvariety.org. Thanks for listening.